From New York City, the world-famous Comedy Cellar presents Live from America Podcast. Live from America Podcast. With Noam Dorman and Hatem Gabber. Live from America Podcast. Where the top experts in the world and the best comics in the nation get together weekly to discuss today's issues as they cover news, culture, politics, comedy, and more with an equal part of knowledge and comedy. And now, here are your hosts, Hatem Gabber and Noam Dorman.
Hello, welcome to Live from America podcast. This is Hatem, alongside me, my good friend, Noam Dorman, owner of the legendary Comedy Cellar.
Hello.
And amazing episode today. We have two of my favorite guests, Michelle and Mike Pesca. Michelle's coming back for the second part of this podcast. It's going to be an amazing story that the star of it are Mike and Michelle, or Michelle and Mike. You know,
do I know this story? I'm gonna hear it for the first time.
I think so, unless you open Mike's emails, then you would know.
Oh, it's in the email? Oh,
whatever. No, it's not in this email, but it's in his emails in general. Or maybe it's in Michelle's emails. I'm not sure, but yeah.
I don't think I know the story. Go ahead.
So, Mike, a good friend, and he's the host of the longest running daily news podcast in history, and he's always in top 20 in Apple. Podcast, and you've seen his work all over MSNBC, CNN. He's written for the Washington Post, Guardian, JQ, and Slate magazines. And he did the Cellar Talks, which, by the way, is gonna go live next month. Mm-hmm. And he's doing a new show. We'll promote it later in Jersey. But welcome, Mike. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me. I'm joining from Florida, where it's very Florida. I had a big Florida experience today. Of
that looks watching. Awesome.
It's nice. This is called the lanai. Is that my pronoun? Lanai. I don't know. They have specific words for patios. So it's a patio. And the lizards, it's so, you know, one of the great things about Florida is whenever you hit something in the road, it's not, you know, a rat, it's a lizard. So that's really nice. It's a nice change of pace.
Why? Rats don't go to Florida? There's no rats in Florida?
I think the lizards eat the rats. It's just a beautiful ecosystem. And another crazy thing about Florida is where I am, I talked to my in-laws. I'm at my in-laws' house, and their community is very pro-Biden. I even looked up all the voting patterns by precinct. It went like 80-20, but even in the immediate area, it's not. And you can get into a conversation about Ron DeSantis where they actually know about his policies, and not everyone hates him. And he's actually kind of delivered some goods for the people of Florida. So that's nice, to a nice break from the people of New York who just know the guy as a caricature, but that, I guess, what he wants to be known as. That's good for him politically.
That's an interesting point. Lanai is Hawaiian for covered porch. There's an island, Lanai. Yeah, that's exactly right. I what you just said is a very clever way of putting it, that it's almost as if he wants to be known as a caricature, despite the fact he seems to be a pretty able administrator. He's done a good job in Florida.
Yeah, I guess he's playing the strategy of, I'm going to only care about getting the Republican nomination at first. And Donald Trump showed, if you get the Republican nomination, you get 40-something percent of the vote. And then at that point, he could be like, all right, you know, all the stuff I did about combating Disney on wokeness, I've also helped the schools. And I've also done pretty well with balancing the budget and things that normal people might.
And COVID.
Well, it's a good, you know, it's funny. That's his big vulnerability, right? Or that's what Trump wants to make into his big vulnerability, that he actually had a sensible COVID policy, but it was sensible about masks. And now I think he's a little too vaccine for my taste, probably your taste too. No, he at least voices anti-vaccine sentiments, which I think are really stupid. Although, as I've been talking about my show, this Corcoran review and all the mask surveys do show they didn't really work on a population level.
Mike, in the community, I wonder, in the community you are right now, you said 80% like Biden. Were they like Biden versus Trump? They went for Biden, or are they Republican and just went for Biden this time?
No, they were. I think they're more Democrat. I think it's like what it does is you'll find a lot of these communities follow where the people used to live. So there's a lot of Northeasterners here, and they come down and they continue voting blue. And they were definitely anti-Trump. It's also, you know, a class divide, but just a couple towns over, and, you know, people you might meet at the grocery store or in the gym will be very different.
But if they would be like Biden, DeSantis, would they go Biden, or they would still go Biden, or they'll go DeSantis?
It's good. I didn't check the DeSantis vote. I think probably DeSantis did pretty well because, of course, he was running against Charlie Crist. And that's another thing that very much annoys me about talking about how good local politicians are. Look at the margin of victory. Well, he ran against someone, right? And usually, or Sarah Palin, she ran against someone and she did very well against that person who Alaskans knew and rejected. And we on the national stage don't even know that Charlie Crist is seen as kind of like a flip-floppy, and I've already talked about lizards, but he is sort of saurine in his demeanor. And so, yeah, maybe DeSantis's big win was because they really hated his opponent.
But it was really big. And he just squeaked it out for the same opponent last time, right? Like,
yes, well, which shows that 4 years of actually running the state, the people actually liked it. I mean, what do you think, Noam, what do you think of the recent pullback in him, in the idea of him as a front runner?
I think that, I'm not into politics as much as I used to. This is what I think off the top of my head, but if it's stupid, you just let me know. First of all, there's regression to the mean that it's always stupid. Happens. There's a horrible story about somebody. People say, oh, God, and then, you know, and then it fades into the background and they return to whatever their kind of basic feeling about that guy was. And then that was pushed along by this incredible luck that Trump had, that Biden had all these classified documents that showed up in his, you know, that really helped Trump. And then Trump's been better lately, and Trump is good. You know, if you read those responses to Tucker Carlson about what their Russia or Ukraine policy would be.
Yeah.
Trump's answer was so much better than DeSantis's. The substance of it was better. The writing. Remember how people used to make fun of Trump's fourth grade English?
Yes.
Trump's writing was so much clearer, so much less parsing mentally, you know, having to figure out what he's trying to say. You could read Trump's thing, just read it, and you understood exactly what he meant, and it was logical.
Yeah.
DeSantis has had clauses and phrases, and what is he referring to? And it seemed like no comparison. So, I mean, I almost found myself warming up to Trump after DeSantis, and I so much don't want Trump to be president.
But, I think you're the only analyst who says, well, you know, Trump's big leg up on DeSantis is the written word, prose, his prose style.
Listen, who came out? Did you read it?
I did read it. And
it was good.
Yes. I think, though, that we've definitely had the correction to the correction. People forget that the reason why Trump 2 months ago was seen as fading is because he had these terrible results in the midterms, and all the most election denial Trump candidates really got hammered. And so you tell me how that's not going to be really salient. And I know it faded a little bit, but when push comes to shove and people make the point, Trump is not going to back off the case that the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th were patriots. And he's not going to back off the case that, you know, Ashley Babbitt was a martyr. And he's just going to go four square behind the election was stolen. And if DeSantis is skilled enough to make that a point over and over, I think it's a huge advantage, even among Republicans. And people who do polling say, you know, like, even if it's you like both of their policies, DeSantis has a pretty good strategy. He's like, you like the policies? You get the policies, same exact policies with me. I'll just execute them competently. And he could also say, and if you really like the policies, I could be president for 8 years and Trump could only be president for four or maybe less if he gets thrown in jail. So I think DeSantis is sitting on a pretty good argument as long as he can make it with words.
I agree with every word you just said. Just so many unknowns. I mean, I agree with every word you said. I felt that way before Trump began to fade. I say, you know, 4 years ago, or 8 years it'll be, he had a message that reverberated with a lot of people, you know, and now his message is petulant and I was robbed. I mean, this is not
I still think that Trump has a lot going on for him. A lot of people don't want to admit it publicly, that they would like Trump more than, you know, and I think it's going to come also to the point where just like last election, Trump lost because people voted for Biden, not because of Biden, but because they didn't want Trump. I think we're coming to that point now that people don't want Biden, you know? So that will be whoever is going to be the Republican. But if you look at anything that Trump does, he's still very popular. The truth, I mean, there's so many people when he was selling these whatever action figures or whatever, sell out in like 5 seconds. Like, he still have a lot of, so it will be interesting. But
can you imagine what an overwhelming favorite Trump would be for the presidency today if he had simply on November 25th, whatever it is, just conceded gracefully?
It's unbelievable.
But
it's
then he wouldn't be Trump. He wouldn't be Trump then. But
he could have done it. He could have conceded. I mean, it would have just all the worries about him being the dictator, whatever, put to bed. He showed himself. His policies have not looked bad in retrospect. Turns out not to be a Russian spy. I mean, up and down, he would be just a shoo-in, I think, right now. But anyway.
So let's speak about what's going on right now. So, Trump is, in the truth, he said that he's expecting through leaks that he will be arrested in a couple of days, on Tuesday. We taped this on Sunday. So it's going out Tuesday. So today he should be arrested, he says. So he calls for a protest of what he claims is his arrest is going to happen, so what's your thoughts on that? Let's go with Mike.
Well, first of all, from what I understand, he has no inside information other than what you or I have, which is, reading the paper and the tea leaves and figuring out when an indictment could come. But I think it's massively different when a petulant private citizen who vows to be your retribution and now in turns ask his people, well, be my retribution. When that person says something like, come rally for me, versus what he did as president. Now, it does remind everyone of what he did as president. And I'll say, if you told me on January 5th that we're going to have people taking a shit on Nancy Pelosi's desk the next day, I would say, I don't believe you. I don't think that's going to happen. So take this with a grain of salt. But all his calls for action or some sort of protest, I can't see it possibly becoming anything close to a threat to democracy. I think it probably will just be like the people who stood across the street at Mar-a-Lago and waved signs when they went inside and executed a search warrant.
Noam, what do you think?
I agree with Mike. I mean, I agree. I mean, I know that this is always the way it is, but liberal people are praying that there will be a riot, because they love that stuff. But I don't think there's going to be. I think Mike's got it 100% right, as usual, Mike.
I like in his truth when he said the leading Republican candidate, he just cannot stop raising himself, even if he's going to jail. And the former president of
Going to jail.
He's not. But that's the thing. I think a lot of people, this is huge. Like, to try to arrest a former president, I think a lot of people will, maybe not in New York, even though NYPD are like on high alert right now for protests and stuff like that. I don't think it's going to happen in New York as much. Maybe not New York City, but maybe somewhere. But there's a lot of people just against the idea itself, or just prosecuting a president, and they think it's crazy.
Can I tell what I mean? The charges are ridiculous. This Stormy Daniels thing. We can talk about that if you want. But zooming out, I'm always at a loss to understand why the obvious move to triangulate, nobody takes it. Like, if Biden would say Trump's horrible, blah blah blah, but we don't want to see him arrested. We want to put this behind us. He already has the people's vote of the people who hate Trump. It's the people like me who can be persuaded. I'm just dying by forbearance. Just say something that shows you want to move forward, that you want to be moderate. You would like to see this acrimony end. Stop calling people Jim Crow. Just stop appealing to your base. This was what Bill Clinton did. It was obvious, and it worked famously well. Why doesn't he do it? I don't get it.
Well, they're helping Trump in a way too. They bring him back to the fight. Go ahead, Mike.
I think his theory of the case is the speech that helped him or his party in the midterms was the Democracy is in Peril speech in Philadelphia. So yeah. If you back away from that, you make yourself look a little like a hypocrite. And I think his theory of the case is the more people who think that Trump is an active menace to democracy, the better for us. And if you say, well, call off the prosecution, not only will the liberal base absolutely fillet you, you'll give up what had been one of the selling points, you know, one of the selling points for your and your party's candidacy. I had Ellie Honig on the show, who I first met at the Comedy Cellar, I think, and he's written a good book and he's got a new podcast. And we were talking about the three different prosecutions. And first of all, we had much more agreement on the shakiness of the Georgia prosecution, because I said, you know, it's very annoying that in the echo chamber that is liberal media, they will always point to one or two sentences like, can you find the votes? But three sentences later, there's somewhat exculpatory language that he could cite that I really don't know if a juror who has to find beyond reasonable doubt would find. That guy really was trying to throw the election versus just putting pressure on state officials to really find votes that he really thought, even if he was wrong, really thought was stolen. So that's Georgia. With this prosecution, I thought Ellie was going to agree with me that, you know, it's even if you can prove that the payoff was for electoral purposes, I mean, and I would think it would be a great defense to say, I'm going to open my books. I've paid off 13 former mistresses. This is a pattern in practice that has nothing to do with the election. That would be great if that was a defense. But even if you could prove that, wouldn't that mandate a fine? And he said that, you know, it wouldn't. He said that a jail term and a jail sentence would necessarily come with the fact that they fought this for so long. I said to him, well, you know, I look at Lev Parnas, the Ukrainian who committed violations of the Voting Act. And he got 20 months, but it was a whole lot of other stuff going on and a whole lot of RICO stuff. And then John Edwards, they tried to prosecute and they couldn't. I mean, they charged him with a crime that would have a jail time, but he got off. I just think that this, you know, in my gut, I don't know if you could prove it. And even if you can, I don't know if it's a jail sentence. So would there really be a riot over someone who, a Trump supporter who so objects to his champion, his retribution getting fined?
I mean, I'll let Noam say, but yeah. I want to say one thing. We had expert after expert after expert legal in this show and in all of that. And every time they say the same thing, oh, this is it for Trump. He's going to get arrested. And Noam and I will always say, like, nope, it's not going to, and it never happened.
No. I'm not saying he's not going to get arrested.
For this specific.
Yeah, I think that Mike's instincts are right.
Yeah,
I mean, that like you can Google. There's some really really smart people who've written, including a former FEC commissioner who wrote about why this is not a crime what Trump did. But he was in the Washington Post. But if you just think about it for a second, what the theory of this case is that Trump was supposed to take campaign donations. Little old ladies donating their money to Trump, and he was supposed to use that to pay off his mistress. Now, is there any doubt that if Trump had paid off his mistress with campaign donations, the narrative would now be he committed a crime. He used campaign donations for personal expenses. The fact is that every candidate, when they get ready to run for office, caps their teeth, cleans their house, washes their car, gets rid of whatever personal business they can.
Mike Pompeo's lost like 40 pounds.
Yeah, that's right. Joins a gym, whatever it is. But so that's one thing. That's one reason it's ridiculous. The other thing, it's, I don't know if this makes it ridiculous, but it's lost here and it bothers me. Trump was being extorted. Trump had a consensual affair with a grown woman who then, when he was about to run for president, started making noises about hurting him. And wanted money for it. He's not actually the unsympathetic character in this story. I mean, he had an affair, but this is not being explained as a guy who was responding to an extortion. And it was. And I think that's important to the story. If you want to see the guy in jail for, you know, trying to respond to an extortion and keeping it a secret. I mean, this is very human.
I mean, this is,
this is not Trump University where he's ripping people off and trying to take people for their money and many other things that we know that Trump has done. This is actually Trump as kind of an innocent victim here, in my
opinion.
Can
you please stop bashing the university I graduated from?
No, so I'm sure his lawyers are going to make that case.
Yeah, I think that what Honig explained to me was that even if you get a partial electoral benefit from doing these things, even if it's mostly personal, still an election crime. And what they care more about is the Mar-a-Lago thing, is the not complying with investigators. So maybe if he had said that, if he had said that early on and said, I was just paying hush money to someone I had an affair with, he'd be better off in terms of the FEC. But then you get into the issue of, well, obviously, I don't want to admit that under oath. That's why you pay hush money. So you don't have to admit that publicly. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what happens, but the original original question was, will there be massive riots about it? It seems... Look, I don't think there are, I don't think the theory of the case of massive riots on January 6th made any sense, but this makes even so much less sense to even put myself in the mind of, is there an oath keeper who wants to protest this?
But January
6th, is that why they strap on the camo? Because of
January 6th wasn't massive. It was effective. It was crazy, but it wasn't massive.
Right. So,
what I'm saying. What if we have few crazy people?
Yeah, but there was so much of what the January 6th Commission did prove is that there was a lot of coordination, maybe not coordination of exactly where we're going to take the dumps when we get inside the Capitol, but there was coordination. This just seems ad hoc. This just seems Trump blowing smoke, and maybe in this case, the smoke will lead to fire, right? Instead of the normal course of things, but I kind of doubt it.
I like the protests that once in a while that's supportive of Trump because it gives us a new ideas for Halloween outfits, you know. So we need that once in a while to get to. But you guys don't agree that this is actually will benefit Trump because more people will sympathize with him, which he will use that momentum perfectly as he always does.
Think of someone who's not already 100,000% MAGA. And think of someone who might be leaning DeSantis because of one of the arguments I said. He's the competent Trump, right? He's the Trump without the baggage. Is their fit of pique over this sufficient that DeSantis, everything else being equal, stops being appealing or is the guy who could run for 8 years or is the guy who has an actual record of government success and actually served in the military? Like, I don't think any of that affects anyone other than the MAGA voter. I think.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. All right. So from one protest to the other, do you want to talk about the Stanford protest? Mike, you want to give us a little bit about it? So
The what protest?
Stanford.
Oh, but before we get on that, what about this footage that Tucker Carlson came out with of this shaman guy pleading for everybody to be nonviolent and thanking the police for letting him in? That bugs me.
Why? Well, don't you see a lot of former alcoholic talk about you got to stop alcohol? Like, he's a perfect non-protester character, I think. You know,
joking. It bugs me because obviously he should have had this. Look, if there was some guy who broke into the Portland Capitol during a BLM riot, some black guy, and they portrayed him as this violent guy, and then he going to jail for 4 years, and then all of a sudden this video shows up of him beseeching everybody to be nonviolent and thanking the cops for letting him in, you know, there wouldn't be anybody saying, but it's on Tucker Carlson. I mean, it's obvious, I think, to me that this looks bad.
I mean, that guy, you know, his biggest mistake, again, like, because there's so many protested, so many did a horrible thing, the outfit he chose, it's so, like, it made him so into the camera. You know,
point. It just feels political. And, you know, and people are complaining that perhaps Tucker Carlson edited the video, although it looks more like he might have cherry picked it than edited it. But of course, the January 6th committee cut out the lines of Trump's speech where he said, I want you to go peacefully and patriotically. And nobody complained about that. As long as you edit it according to the narrative that we prefer, we're fine with it. But all right, that's a hearing. I only believe in the adversarial process, and I almost don't even watch anything that's not adversarial because I know in my heart it will never be truthful. It will always be unreliable. But this guy's going to jail, and the standards, and he has constitutional rights of a fair trial and a fair procedure. And it doesn't seem to me it was fair. And I want to add one more thing. They keep talking about 40,000 hours. But the truth is, and I haven't heard anybody say this, but I know it's true. If you upload that 40,000 hours to Google Photos, in 24 hours, it will find every frame of that shaman guy. And, you know, like the AI facial recognition of Google Photos, and I'm sure the government has similar technology, can instantly find this guy for the purposes of discovery in every single frame that he's in all the government's records. So I don't see how they can use that excuse anymore that somehow this was hard to find.
Well, you don't even need advanced technology to find the only guy with horns. I mean, no. Just at it to find the guy with fur and horns, and then you got him.
Well, you gotta have 40,000 hours.
Right. But you know who else had those 40,000 hours? I think it was a feckless move of Kevin McCarthy just to give it to Tucker Carlson. But all the defense attorneys had that. Jacob Chansley, that is the QAnon shaman, his lawyers had that.
No, and his lawyers claim they didn't. His lawyers have been on TV saying they did not have it and they're upset about it.
Oh, well, I don't know what. But this is like trying to defend anyone on a charge by showing footage of them not doing the crime. So, you know, the murderer who stalked outside the house, I'm sure during some portions of the day he was eating peanuts before
That's
he went into
point.
The house.
That's not the point. A procedure has to be fair.
He's in jail already. He's in prison. And the judge at his sentencing found him extremely sympathetic and said, there's nothing I could do. And you're still getting, I don't know if it was the maximum, but it was like something like 4 years in jail. And he certainly was given that amount of time to be made an example of because he was the QAnon shaman. I don't object to that terribly. He was one of a few, maybe a dozen people who were inside the Senate chamber. He was extremely vocal. He had a bullhorn. People followed him. I saw Tucker Carlson saying he did this thing where he edited together liberals calling him the QAnon shaman. And Tucker's point was he was trying to hype. They were trying to hype how pernicious this guy was. He's just a regular guy named Jacob Chansley. Who called him the QAnon shaman first? First was what's his name from Texas? The crazy guy.
Ted Cruz?
No, the
you didn't the narrow it down very much to the crazy guy from Texas.
The guy who denied the school shootings. What's his name?
Oh, Alex Jones?
Yes, Alex Jones was the first person to dub him QAnon shaman. And then he's a shaman. He'll talk to you for hours about being a shaman. So Tucker Carlson's trying to rehabilitate the guy. Oh, it's only a liberal conspiracy to call the guy the QAnon shaman. That's his own branding. That's what he owned. He was one of 12 people inside the Senate chamber. I interviewed Luke Mogelson, who took the footage inside the Senate chamber. I knew beforehand he was extremely nice to the cops. There was a lot of information out there about the guys inside the Senate chamber being very, very hospitable and very polite to the police, but it doesn't matter. They just still broke the law in this, I think, black and white way.
I strongly disagree with you. I think that getting into the merits of what he did or he didn't do is not proper because we don't know what he did or didn't do. We only think we know because that's what a trial is for. He's innocent until proven guilty. And just like if the government obtains evidence illegally or withholds evidence, that procedure is no longer fair. And we can try to predict what would have happened otherwise, but we don't know. He took a plea.
Yes.
Would he have taken a plea if he'd known that he had evidence of this video that he could show to a jury? Because obviously when you take a plea, you're accused of other crimes, they get dropped. So it's always a little deceptive because what you're charged with is not what you would have been charged with. The reason he took a plea was obviously to get out from under more serious charges. But maybe he wouldn't have been afraid of those more serious charges if he had this evidence. We don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. The procedure has to be proper. And if it's not, I mean, I'm sure you could make an analogy to whatever happened to the Central Park joggers. You just don't ever know. You think you know. And there's a political aspect to this, which, as I said, if this were a black guy, BLM, everybody who's against me now would likely be on my side. They'd be making the same arguments I'm making, and they'd be right. I am not defending this guy. I don't like Tucker Carlson at all. But that's irrelevant how I feel about Tucker Carlson. Just like people who wouldn't entertain lab leak arguments because they hated Trump and Trump made the argument. It's really a way to find yourself wrong in an argument is if you're just repelled by the person making it, as opposed to keeping an open mind about, you know, he's presenting it video. He's not actually making arguments.
Right. I just didn't see anything that on the video that even though it showed tons of not tons, it showed portions of footage in which he was behaving, let's say politely, as polite as a guy dressed like that, carrying a spear the whole time, right? It wasn't a flagpole. He was literally carrying a spear the whole time while inside the Capitol and while offering a prayer
in the Senate chambers. Thanking the cops for letting him in. He's charged with trespassing. Now, doesn't he create reasonable doubt right there, or at least have the right to think that he might have been able to create that? Say, listen, obviously, if the cops let me in, I'm not going to get convicted of trespassing. I can't prove they let me in. All of a sudden, there was video of them letting me thanking them. I wasn't I never thought anybody would see them.
I think it's a small portion of the sentencing. I think if it is true that the rules of discovery were violated and his defense lawyer, who I don't just take on faith value, his defense lawyer was denied or was not given this very important video, that's a terrible procedural problem that needs to be addressed. But I did read everything that the judge said. He seemed really, the judge talked about how contrite the guy seemed, and he talked about Chansley's military history, but I can't go below the sentencing guidelines, which is like 4.5 years. However, after contrite military Chansley went to jail, he's been doing all these interviews where, you know, just look up on YouTube where he essentially backtracked on all the remorse that he was said to have expressed. So if the whole thing, if your point is that discovery was improper, that can't be allowed to stand. But if your point is that these portions of the footage would have made such a big difference that he would have rolled the dice with the trial, I don't know that would have happened. I don't think it would have happened. I think he may be serving more times after a jury found him guilty, like they found the Proud Boys guilty, who there was, you know, it wasn't a slam dunk case, but they were found guilty of seditious conspiracy, which is a much more serious charge than this guy, on evidence of that was a bit weaker in some ways.
Well, I'm not, you know, burdened by all the facts like you are. So I don't know.
It's liberating, isn't it?
Just as in a very human way. When I saw that video of that guy telling, he says, we are not Antifa. We are not we are not going to be violent like they are. And thanking the cops for letting him in. And I think about him spending 3.5 years in jail. I'm like, that's a pretty harsh sentence.
And the spear is just part. The spear is just part of the outfit. It's not, you know, for any, you know.
But it's not a prop spear. It's a pointed spear.
It's not. That's why you should always know how to dress before you go to a certain event. So let's go to the Stanford protest. Yeah. Mike, you want to tell us a little bit about it, since I know nothing about it.
Yes. So a very Trump appointee, right wing judge spoke at Stanford University. And the students there, he spoke because he was invited by the Federalist Society, which is the conservative society that is behind, I think, all of the conservatives on the Supreme Court. And he was shouted down. The protesters or the people in the class, some of whom weren't part of the class he was speaking to, they could claim something about my right to free speech, but there's something called the heckler's veto. And he was given the heckler's veto. And then, and this happens on campus, which doesn't excuse it at all, but this is just how especially large elite campuses are organized. They think that they're in the right and doing the moral thing by yelling at an esteemed judge who you're going to have to understand his way of thinking if you're ever going to argue before him. They think they're doing the right thing. But then an administrator from Stanford I watched the whole thing. It was a 7 to 10 minute speech where essentially 6.5 minutes in, she allowed the fact that, yes, Stanford's policies say that you could speak and that we can't shout you down. But she kept saying this phrase, but is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the juice worth the squeeze? By which she meant, is the fact that these people are upset worth you being here making them upset? Which to me is in a law school, mind-blowingly backwards way to interpret the value of free speech. if we could always say, well, this guy's going to say something, but wait a minute, that something might be upsetting, and therefore we're going to ask you not to say the thing. That just to me seems a generation removed from just being anti-free speech. So Stanford itself actually chastised, criticized that that dean who did this long speech where she very much said all the harm that he has done and all the harm that he has caused. And they chastised her. And then there was, of course, another protest over that. The last thing that happened is the dean of Stanford, who's on the right side of these issues, as far as I could tell, which is that you got to stand up for free speech, especially in a law school. She was silently protested where people lined up around the halls of her classroom and walked out of her classroom. And I used social pressure to make the few students, from what I heard, 10 out of 60, who actually attended her class the day of the protest, feel very put upon. I don't know exactly how I feel about that. I think in terms of free speech and First Amendment grounds, there's no problem legally or procedurally. But and let's also say that the judge himself was he was nasty. He was looking for a fight. He insulted the students. He taped the students going in. That's true. You know, this wasn't Judge Learned Hand. This wasn't someone who floated above the fray. But I think the entire incident, to me, shows that, well, leadership did the right thing, but 50 out of 60 people in the classes. So that percentage, which is more than 90%, whereas 88% of Stanford as an elite institution is not understanding free speech as I think it should be understood.
No, most of your thoughts on that.
I'm wondering how Mike got 88% so quickly. How did you do that, Mike?
Well,
you divided sixty into ten, 1/6. Okay. Is that it?
Yeah, it's something like this. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we could put share the screen and we could do division and we could do.
I think the key is always to say it with confidence, because if you say anything with confidence, just like it seems legit.
So, exactly.
Go ahead. No.
I agree with Mike, and I actually find it frightening. I mean, the constant. How much more evidence do we need about the fact that the young generation doesn't value free speech? There was a time when, you know, stuff was happening on college campuses and the smart people said, well, they're just kids, they'll grow out of it. And now all of a sudden adults are behaving with all these trigger warning and blah, 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 the stuff that Mike knows better than anybody about. These are the legal experts and Supreme Court justices of tomorrow. And one of the counterfactuals that I've never totally come to terms with in my own mind is, was Trump worth it for the conservative Supreme Court? Now, I know people are outraged about Dobbs and the abortion decision. The jury's still out on that and, you know, what the full consequences of that will or won't be. They haven't yet, I think, emerged to be as serious as we thought they would be. But they're, you know, even if it's consequences to one person, that's still serious. But the idea that the Supreme Court is going to stand up for free speech, at least for the foreseeable future, as opposed to what would happen if we had a liberal Supreme Court, liberal Supreme Court right now, I don't know what the answer to that is, but I'm kind of comfortable knowing that the Supreme Court is conservative and very sympathetic to free speech. And by the way, they've been good on trans rights and gay rights. And they, you know, there's a lot of things, nobody wants to give them credit, but there's a lot of things that this conservative Supreme Court has been good on that liberals are concerned about. But free speech, that used to be the big one that liberals worried about. And now the conservative court is an obstacle in the, whatever the phrase, you know, is an obstacle to people who are trying to limit free speech.
Well, I think among the Supreme Court, I actually take a little bit of inverse view, which is I think especially Judge Kagan is pretty good on free speech. I think she used to be an administrator, dean of Harvard Law School. And I would like to think, and I do think, that if she were in this position, she'd side with what the Stanford administrator said, which is that this guy needs to be allowed to speak. Ketanji Brown Jackson has been on the court too short an amount of time to know exactly what she'd say about free speech. I think it's generational. I think that a lot of law schools, a lot of elite institutions are very fearful of the younger generation, which to me is when you are Stanford or Yale and you have the ballast of hundreds of years behind you, and especially in the case of places like that, you are the pipeline for the Supreme Court. You can stand up to it. You can stand up for what the actual constitutional definition of free speech is, which it was very much tied in with the idea of content neutrality when it came to what the argument was. And that has fallen out of favor among young protesters. And the idea of silence equals violence, or when you said she was on the other foot, and what if a liberal was protested, they wouldn't even recognize that as a legitimate argument. They honestly wouldn't think they were just trying to advance their side. They would frame it as, well, but no liberals are doing harm to that degree. There is no harm being perpetrated, and therefore it is not even a free speech issue. Or of course we have to allow liberals to speak. It's a totally different issue. It's nothing to do with speech. They taped protest posters all over the dean's classroom saying, what about our rights to free speech? Which is good that we have some rules. I like rules, that especially if you follow them, which is that the heckler's veto is not free speech. Yelling at someone so they can't speak, that is anti-free speech. That is not the free speech of the person in the audience. And thank God that Stanford, at least eventually, not the dean, it present in the moment, but eventually the Uber apparatus said, yeah, we're defining free speech in a just in a way that makes sense and has made sense for a number of years.
Yeah. Well, hold on. Let me make this point. So I wasn't foreseeing this particular case being somehow tried in the Supreme Court. I'm saying that the attitudes of these law students might be predictive of what future jurisprudence has in store for us, and what some current, there's plenty of these people who are already out of law school, maybe Ketanji Jackson. Now, the court already, so Citizens United, which was a free speech case, which the ACLU and Lawrence Tribe, by the way, both thought was correctly decided. You already saw the democratically appointed justices going the other way. Mm-hmm. And so that's already, you begin to see a little divergence. And I don't know what the geometry of that divergence would lead to, but you're already separating. And understand that case meant that, I think somebody did a documentary about Hillary Clinton right before the election. And if that case had gone the other way, an American would not have been able to produce a documentary about a presidential candidate right before an election. I mean, it's kind of an outrageous thing. And they were ready to do that because these corporations are not people. But of course, you know, just to, I don't, what I'm saying, what I'm about to say might be stupid because I haven't thought it through, but Dominion is now suing for defamation.
Yeah.
And that's a corporation. And I haven't heard one person say, no, corporations are not people. Dominion can't sue for defamation. So I think this idea that corporations are not people is really not something that people really believe, because corporations are a legal structure that people use for whatever practical reasons they have to use them in our system. You can't just expose yourself to all kinds of liabilities in order to preserve your rights of free speech. But if you choose to have a corporation, now say, aha, you formed a corporation because you really have no choice. And now the corporation doesn't have free speech. So in any event, I'm jumbling a lot of stuff. I'm just worried about the direction. I heard it speculated that Kennedy resigned when he did because of this very issue, that he was more comfortable with Trump appointing his replacement because he was worried specifically about the free speech issue. I read that Times or the Post or something like that. Don't know if it's true, but it rang true to me when I read it. Anyway, nobody.
I think
it's not provable. Kids, none of this is provable.
I think the kids, when they grow up more and they get into politics and they know that they have to do what they have to do, they're gonna change. It's not gonna be the same. And he blocked my joke when Mike was saying, you know, if you're in the audience, yelling is not free speech. I was gonna say, where I come from, we don't yell from the audience; we're just throw shoes.
Well, but this is
George Bush, nothing on that.
But this is where it is, Hatem. The likely thing will be some sort of give on the idea of hate speech. That certain speech that is considered hateful, using the N-word or whatever it is, they will make some sort of exception. Like they along the lines of the exception they tried to make for pornography. And then there was the foot in the door. And then you wake up in a country 40 years from now that's defining hate speech to mean things that people, well, they're already doing it, right? To mean things that people just really don't agree with. And maybe lab leak is hate speech because lot of liberals were saying that at the time. And we don't need this. We don't need this in this country, in my opinion. I think Mike agrees with me, but the younger generation doesn't see it that way.
Yeah, I think the big challenge, the big worry isn't actually even in the jurisprudence on free speech per se. It's on the ethos of free speech, which has changed radically. And it's on the idea of disinformation, which I was agnostic on. I mean, there definitely seems to be a lot of disinformation floating around, and there are technological ways to disseminate it that have never happened before. So let's not be stupid about it. On the other hand, it just has become clear there are case after case after case where what you call disinformation is just the information you don't like. And now I get more and more weary. And this is how free speech and the First Amendment and the changing definition of what free speech is. We can still have a body of law that says, okay, it's not a riot under Brandenburg unless there are fighting words. We can have certain free speech doctrines that don't change. And at the same time, have an office of disinformation where... sorry, this is a little sidetrack, but come on, what if Biden established that office of disinformation, then Trump wins the election? How do you think he'd weaponize the office of disinformation? So I worry about free speech, the government getting into the anti-disinformation game. It's troubling. And I do not, in this case, look to the law students of Stanford as the voices of the future who I could depend on.
But I'll tell you what I think about this, and then we got to get Michelle in. You know, the problem is not young people. Like, yes, young people now, they go in a certain direction. But I think once you get hit of life, once you start bending the law a little bit, once you start knowing somebody good who says something, but you know they don't mean it, they're going to change. The problem is that older people now worried about the younger people vote. So they go in that direction versus when they're supposed to correct it and stand for what they believe in, just like Stanford should, you know. But I think eventually, once you grow up out of, you know, it's a beautiful world and the right way is this way. And then, you know, it starts hitting you and your life and your neighbors and everything. You're going to change. You're going to have some bones in it. So we'll see. So where's Michelle?
Here she comes.
She's
going to tell you about our story, which starts with, here comes Michelle. I'll start by saying that we were contacted by Airbnb. We have an Airbnb and we had some vacancy. And so someone within an Airbnb or an agency said, oh, with this vacancy, would you like to house some Ukrainian refugees for the amount of vacancy you have? A couple of weeks, right? You want to take it from there, honey?
Sure. Hi, guys.
Hi.
How are you? Apparently there was an organization called Nova Ukraine that was using Airbnb as a platform to connect refugees with people who had vacancy in their housing. And so they saw that we had vacancy and we brought them on initially for 4 weeks. They stayed about closer to six. But it's been, you know, we're still there. They've moved out as of a week ago, which was a story in and of itself. But we're still working with them. And, you know, we plan to continue to help them get resettled here in New York.
And the reason they moved out is that Michelle facilitated all of this. So when we took these people on, what the Nova didn't have any rules for us, just you have a room. These people need a room. And then you'll tell them about the family and their actual needs. But I tried to orient myself. I said, well, what do I need to know? So I found that the State Department was actually, they had some materials to orient people who are hosting refugees. And they would talk about, I actually voluntarily did a training manual or module, which seems like a terrible thing to do, right? Since they're, I think all training modules are only designed so that the company doesn't get sued, but I did it. And what I learned was, that you have to really be a social worker, in a phrase. You think you're just hosting people or maybe having some money. You can never, don't get upset with them. They're going to have different ideas. Don't tell them what to do. Don't do things for them. Just facilitate their integration into US society. All right, that alone seems hard. But then the realities of housing in New York City, the realities of the fact that the sponsorship organization Nova kind of stopped working with Airbnb and we had no help on that side. It really, really proved challenging. And so basically, Michelle became their full-time social worker. And why don't you tell them about the family and their needs?
Yeah, well, that was the kind of gap, I think, in the process. And I think they were just trying to meet their sort of minimum demands of, you know, like their basic needs of like having housing. And then we were kind of on our own to figure out the rest. So it was a huge learning curve in terms of even just understanding what their needs were. It was fortunate for us that the mother of the family speaks English pretty well, which is not the situation with a lot of these other families. And we've, you know, kind of tapped into the community of people who are helping refugees and now understand that there's a lot of people who are in the situation that we were in that can't even have like basic lines of communication with their families because they don't speak English.
So the mom is Svetlana. The dad is Sergei. He's a trained electrician, which is good because he'll be able to get work in the United States, although he has to relearn our wiring. Their youngest son is 2 years old. He needs to get into school. And their oldest son, Dima, is 10.
12,
and he has autism. And that is one reason why they fled first to Moldova, then to France, then came here, and to work with someone who has autism and to work with the New York school system to try to get not just this refugee family, but this kid with these needs that the government says we will address. That has been a major obstacle. But the biggest obstacle is housing in New York. And I talked about this on my show. That we all know as New Yorkers, it's tough. It's really tough. It's really rough. But you don't know how bad it is until you deal with a situation where, well, we raised about $23,000 for them by talking about them on the Gist and by putting it out there on social media. And so that should give you a number of months of rent, but it just doesn't. Landlords want a guarantor, and they want their guarantor to have 80 times the amount of money that the rent is. They essentially wanted Sergei to show that he had $100,000 in income. They want security and they want first month, and it's just so impossible. So you think, oh, what about Section 8 housing vouchers? You ever hear of them? I don't know if you knew this. They haven't had a new Section 8 housing voucher since 2009. That's basically a program that's a myth. And during the pandemic, they tried to do it again. And people don't even take Section 8 housing vouchers. What about getting them into public housing? All of these are no-goes. And the city literally says, well, our advice is to put them into the shelter system. And until they go into the shelter system, we can't even begin to help them officially. People are nice. Agencies are nice. They'll give you food. They'll give you clothing. They'll give you resources. They help Sergei with a job. When it came to housing, there's nothing they could do. So you need to become homeless.
You know, I have a couple of questions. First of all, I'm just curious, what is the American policy on accepting refugees? Are we limited like we did to Syrian refugees? Have we swung the door open? Do you know?
Yeah, Biden swung it open and he articulated a goal of, I forgot how many thousand, 100,000. We haven't even reached the goal yet. So these people have benefited. Our family has benefited. They're here legally. They have, you know, they're vaccinated and they have working papers and, you know, all the things that you would want for, like, we're behaving like a decent country, finally.
Yeah, we were very stingy. We were very stingy with the Syrians, inexplicably.
Well, it's not just that. It's like all these rumors of, you know, they're going to sneak terrorists into our midst and all that stuff.
Well, that's part of not being European, being from the Middle East. But, you know, again, that's a different conversation.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. So that's that.
But it wasn't the way with, I was just thinking of like, you know, Vietnam and the so-called boat people or even the Cuban, the terrorism worry wasn't so prominent, but go ahead, Noam.
Yeah. So you know, people are so broken down and, you know, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. It's a shame because, you know, what you just described to me actually was interesting in light of this new club that I'm opening. So we bought this real estate and one of the things, the real estate has air rights. So this is great. Maybe we can build some apartments above there and have the club. It'd obviously make the economics better. But you learn right away that the city is completely inhospitable to anybody building new apartments. You have to have setbacks and this and that and a community board and over the top handicap access and all things. Every little one of these things makes sense if you're coming from a progressive point of view. You say, oh, that makes sense. That makes sense. That makes sense. But it's death by a thousand cuts, and the law of unintended consequences is in front of everybody's eyes to see it.
I think it's an intended consequence. I think the established landlords understand supply and demand and don't want product on the market.
I don't think so I don't think so. You could be right, or you could be right to some degree, but I think there are plenty of land developers and landlords who would like to. I became a landlord. I would like to build apartments.
Right.
You can't do it. And even what you described about needing all these guarantors. Well, why do they need the guarantors? Because after years of judges, again, with a good heart, making it impossible to evict anybody, and all the sort of people like, we squatted for 3 years and didn't pay the guy a dime. Ha ha, high five. Oh, that's great, you know? But then now nobody can get an apartment without being rich.
That's exactly what we just kind of became like glaring in our face. It's like you kind of understand these things in theory, but in practice, just became so obvious.
I called it crossing the experiential threshold, where if you told me that a year ago, I'd say, oh yeah, you're right. Now, having gone through it, it's horrible. We don't even blame the people who don't want to rent to them, they're vulnerable. And Michelle's an architect, and she has combated the ADA requirements and the, air rights and the setbacks. And it's kind of crazy here in New York, right?
Yeah. I mean, what I was going to say, though, was that, what you said, Noam, is absolutely right. The laws are in the favor of the tenant, and everybody is hyper aware of that. So every landlord has to be extremely on guard and make sure that every tenant is vetted to the nth degree. And even under the best of circumstances, which is something that I tried to explain to the family, which was absolutely impossible for them to understand, is that in the best of circumstances, even with proper income, it's nearly impossible to get an apartment. And, if I was a single person, even as a professional architect who's been working for over 20 years, I would have a difficult time getting an apartment here in New York on my own. It's extremely discouraging. But, I think it was what was really disheartening was trying to explain this to the family and their sort of inability to understand, how come they can't get assistance from the government? How come there are no programs in place? Because in Europe, there are. And that was a very difficult hurdle for them to understand. And then also just on a basic level, they're like, we've raised a pile of cash for them. Any landlord, they were saying, in Ukraine would be thrilled to take this pile of cash up front for an apartment. And there was nobody that was willing to accept that on their behalf.
No. And I think it's great. Like when I received your emails about it, and I know that your job or your vision in the beginning was to house them in your Airbnb, and then you got involved in everything: education, childcare, employment, housing. Like you made it your headache, and I think that's a great example. I mean, like we can argue a lot about like a lot of things, politics of the city, the rules, why Syrian refugees are not one. But I think the main thing for me was, the example that you're setting of helping people for no reason at all, just putting yourself in that position. And then, and I think that's something awesome. And I think, and that's why one of the reasons I wanted to promote it as well in this podcast, so people can help out if they can. But it's a big headache. I've seen a soccer game, and there's one Ukrainian girl playing, and she couldn't understand and there's another kid, Russian, that was explaining to her, and this is just human at its best. It's Russian and Ukrainian, and she's explaining to her the rules of the game. And this is what makes, with everything else going on, crazy, just these moments that makes it, great.
While we're talking about selfless acts, and the Pescas are absolutely to be congratulated and emulated. I mean that very sincerely. There was another selfless act. Someone, we don't know how it happened, gave Hatem a heart transplant. It's coming up on 3 years tomorrow, did you say?
Yeah.
3 years tomorrow. Yeah. We have our Hatem with us for the foreseeable future.
Oh, my God.
Thanks to the selfless act of somebody who gave up their heart. I suppose they gave it when they knew they were dying, but still, or somebody's That's family amazing. Or however it happened. So these things matter, right?
Absolutely. And the world we live in, you know, that's why I thank you. Yeah. I mean, like, it's, you know, obviously I always say, like, when it comes to like living and dying, it's funny because in the hospital, it doesn't matter if you're black or white or Jewish or Muslim or Christian, or all that matters is that you're human. You take that part from one human to put in another human. That's all that matters, you know? Yeah. And, you know, in the soccer game, I see a Russian girl translating to Ukrainian girl about how, what's the rules are, you know, selfish acts like this, what you guys doing. And I've seen, you know, how you make it. And I know how busy you are and you still make it, you know, and it's frustrating dealing with somebody, obviously from another country. They don't get it. You know, they don't get a lot of rules. And you like, in a way you understand why this is happening. But so all these with this horrible world, I think like is a highlighted stuff that we need to share with people. I wish people follow the examples of what you do.
Well, we've been, you know, trying to help this family by connecting with our community. And it's been an amazing experience for us as well. I mean, frustrating at times, yes, for sure, for a variety of reasons. But I feel really lucky that we have had this opportunity to make such a direct impact for this family. Like, it's really a blessing for us, too. I just don't think that, you know, it landed in our lap. We didn't seek it out. And it's not often that you have an opportunity to make such a direct impact in somebody's lives. And you know, we're
just land in your lap. You know how many times I go, it's like, do you want to donate 50 cents to that? I'm like, no, that's fine.
But
you
that's know, money. That's what I mean.
No, yeah. But I'm saying like it was there and you identified and you decide to make that decision. Yeah. You fell in a way, but you could have ignored it. You could have just been like, okay, I'll give it 3 weeks and I did great, you know?
Yeah,
I will give a plug to that flag behind you a little bit, which the Denyushkins, our family, wanted to say, oh, we just want to thank America. But the point you made about the young Russian girl and the young Ukrainian girl, I think that's a very distinctly American phenomenon. And I think the culture of America of getting along those lines, interpersonal lines, is something that maybe we're losing, but I don't see it as much in other countries. Just by necessity, America, you know, a land of what we used to call the melting pot and different people getting along. And, you know, Svetlana says her native language is Russian. And she is one of those Russian speakers in Ukraine who Putin he convinced himself that those people would support him. But they don't. And now Svetlana won't even acknowledge that her language is Russian, right? She says, no, I speak Ukrainian when it is Russian. But she goes to these stores to buy her Ukrainian food and she speaks with the Russian proprietors. And, you know, not only do they get along, it's an absolute lifeline. And yes, America didn't do great when it came to the refugees compared to Canada. We're not doing great. We are doing great in terms of arming these people, which is, I think, unbelievably necessary. But there is something about maybe not the law or how it's practiced, but just the history of civic life in America that allows this sort of thing to go.
Absolutely. When I first moved here, I'll tell you an interesting story. When I first moved here, and this is when I said, like, oh, my God, this country is amazing. I was in a strip club. And there was a stripper right next to me. And I'm talking to her. And then after she's done, she left to get a drink. And on one side, it was me. Her other side, it was a Hasidic Jew. And we locked eye. And it's like, we finally meet at peace. We're here for the same purpose.
I would add, you know, we think history doesn't happen anymore. But I guess every nationality at one time or another was forged by some historical events, and we're seeing the Ukrainian nationality, to the extent it always existed, but it was a quasi-nationality in some ways historically, if you really read about it. And I've read a little bit about it the last couple of days, but it ain't going to be a quasi-nationality anymore. And it reminds me a little bit of the Palestinian nationality. My father was very slow to accepting that the Palestinians were a distinct nationality from Arabs, you know. But then he came around to it later, because at some point their historical experience became so unique to them that it became a real nationality if it wasn't prior. Maybe there's an analogy there. I don't know. But anyway, it was just interesting to see it happening.
And I think that that's definitive at this point. Svetlana explains to us that her family, who is still in Russia, she's had to cut off all ties with them at this point, because they speak to her and they explain to her how this is in their best interest. And this is all for the best for them, for their family, for their future. And they're just being fed such propaganda. This is her own family, her own blood, that are telling her that this is for the best for her and her family. And it's just, I don't think there's any coming back. Yeah.
So from your conversation with her, what is the situation there? What would you say the percentage of people that actually believe that they should be part of Russia versus, the people that believe in Ukraine?
Well, if they were harboring inklings to that degree the day the bombing started in Ukraine, I think that went out the window. And I think that, from reading about this, Putin's theory of the war is he would say there is really no such thing as Ukraine. And even if I think that was wrong then, but even if it was a myth at one point, he took that myth and breathed it into life. There now is a Ukraine. Yeah, yeah. And it's because of him. It's because Ukraine rallied against what he's done. And so who knows? There could be now a Ukraine national identity that is crushed under the boot of the Russians, and Russia could be occupying now a foreign country. That's all possible. It depends on how arms shipments go. But the idea of a nation is something that Putin created. And like Michelle was saying, it's definitely an idea that maybe wasn't, or if at best, incipient in the hearts of these people, and now a real reality.
Best I can gather, there were shades of Ukrainian nationalities, all the way from people who considered themselves Russian but knew they had Ukrainian background to people who really, were adamantly Ukrainian, and every kind of 60, 40, 70 in between.
Yes.
And now just everybody just kind of pushed to
the... Yeah, it was to the point where when it was a murky nationality and they would poll the people of that nationality, they would say, especially Russian speakers, we want to work with Russia. They were open to having a productive relationship with Russia. But now that it's a war, it's a hard and fast nationality. And, part of that nationality is defending Ukraine as qua Ukraine, as they say.
I have to go. I wish this conversation in the Olive Tree, we could talk for another 2 hours, but Hatem, I have to go. I have a hard out at 5:10.
You have a what?
A hard out. I said I have a hard out and it's 10.
Well, yeah, it's a great conversation. And I the last thing I want to ask is, a lot of people fight for the identity, but I wonder, would they go back to Ukraine?
Or they want to they be really
here? I know a lot of people that want to stay here and don't go back.
I think they definitely want to go back.
Thank you.
Bye, Noam.
Bye, bye. Very nice to see you.
Nice to see you. They had saved up kind of their entire adult lives to buy an apartment, and they had just purchased this apartment 5 months before the war began. And so sort of everything that they had worked for in their entire lives, they left. They came here with 4 suitcases, and they just kind of fled in the middle of the night. And they really do hope that they can go back. They just don't know what they will go back to.
I see a lot of people from different parts of the world where there's problems in that part, and then they moved here, and the first generation do want to go back, but then they realize it's better for the kids here. And like Mike said, the United States of America is the greatest, in my opinion, he didn't say that, but I'm saying it is the greatest country in a lot of ways, maybe not politics, maybe not, but the people, the living here, stuff like that, so I feel would it be better for them to stay here or to go back?
I think they're, they can't even see 2 weeks in front of them at this point. Absolutely. And they're so overwhelmed with all of the hurdles that they have to get through. And those hurdles are very cyclical. It's like one kind of feeds into the next and feeds into the next. So it's difficult for them to get out of these loop of problems that they have. But I think if they are able to get themselves settled here, it's definitely a possibility for them. She's always had a dream of living in New York. She just said, I never thought it would be under these circumstances.
I think maybe we haven't talked about this, but maybe a determinant will be Dima, their 10-year-old, has had you know, services in Ukraine. He's autistic. So they will be able to, let's give it a year, they will be able to compare the quality of the services, the quality of the progress, and maybe that'll be the pure determinant.
Yeah.
Okay.
And America, I guess we said something about the ADA before. America is really, really good when it comes to its treatment of the disabled and its treatment. It's a world leader. And they even have, I remember reading a story about how an international disability organization booked, they always book their international conferences. And for years it was in the US. And one year they booked it in some crazy place like Toronto. And it just didn't work for them, you know? Yeah. So we do beat ourselves up. We deserve to beat ourselves up. We do some things right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not the housing.
I mean, there's a lot of things, even in the disability. Like I was, you know, especially when I was involved in a lot of projects with this, and you know, just the application part, when you go apply for it, when you're still sick and you need help, like, you know, when I was sick and I'm trying to, and you have to go to the office and wait in line. I was like, I remember one time I waited in line for 3 hours, and when my turn came, I was too sick to stay and they left, you know. So the paperwork, the stuff like that, but still I believe that compared to others, you know, this is a great thing. But I wanted to say, like, before we go, is like, you know, we like, I don't want to, like, if you're listening, don't think about like why Ukrainian, why not Syrian, why this, why that. Don't think about do I support Ukraine, the money going there. So think about in a human level, just a human level, let's just try to help this family right now and take them. And I think you, Michelle and Mike, you're doing an amazing job. So how can people help? If people are listening right now and they want to help, how could they help?
Thank you. I really appreciate that. There's a link to a GoFundMe campaign that we set up for this family. What we've raised so far has...
I'll have this link in the description.
Thank you so much. That's the probably best way. You know, people, if anybody is in the New York area and has opportunity for electrician jobs, Mike mentioned the husband is a master electrician with 20 years of experience. He is in need of a full-time job that has a livable salary and preferably where they speak Russian.
It's kind of specific. I right? know, like when you click all the filters, they're 300, 200, one. No.
But that's another thing. If somebody's listening and they have kids the same age and they speak Russian or Ukrainian and they want to talk to someone,
absolutely,
make friends, I think yes, it would be a good way to, especially for the kids, you know.
They're looking for community. Now they're in Sunnyside, Queens, and so I believe they're looking for a community to connect with there. If anybody has connections with the autism community, we just got the son placed into school. There's some issues around that, which I can go on for quite a while about. The youngest son is in desperate need of daycare. And so he's 2.5 and he really needs daycare to free the parents up so that they have the ability to work. So,
and, you know, International Autism Day is coming April 2nd. And, you know, we actually releasing this, the first Seller Talk with Clint Watts, talking about his daughter and her experience with autism. Mm. And it's going to be, it's going to get a lot. It's already going to be in, you know, the Daily Show and few shows and TV.
Oh, wonderful.
For the Seller Talk. So, you know, also that I'll put a link there. So hopefully people can help. But yeah, if you can help in any way, please, you know, you can go to the GoFundMe or you can email
Michelle, Mike. Yep.
You can email us here, liveamerica@comedyseller.com, and I'll forward them the email. Also, what's your email? Or people can find it. Just go to your website.
I think the gist is good.
You could email michelle@mikepesca.com.
Okay. So okay. michelle@mikepesca.com. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. This is awesome.
Thank you, Hatem. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And congrats on 3 years.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And also bonding with that Hasidic Jew.
That was
heartwarming.
All right, guys.